Welcome to Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Ashkan Kazarian. Today, we're going to talk about law enforcement as political weapon. President Donald Trump has been very vocal in criticizing many things, including those who he deems his political opponents. However, this criticism often extend to threats of legal action using antitrust or tax law and government agencies to go after those who he criticizes. How does this compare to past administrations? How lawful is this kind of intervention? We have Justin Florence, legal director for Protect Democracy, joining us to talk about this, and our own leader of a free world, tech free world, president of Tech Freedom, Baron Zoka. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Before we dive in, Justin, do you want to share a few sentences about what Protect Democracy does? Your name is very vague. I'm not sure. Your name is very vague.
So we tried to keep it simple when we named the organization. It's a new nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, started a little over a year ago, with the theory that some of the things that we've seen happen in democracies in other countries that were once stable democracies but have declined into more authoritarian governments, that some of those same trends could happen here in the US, and that there was no organization focused on that threat. So we formed with the mission of protecting our democracy, as our name says, from a decline into a more authoritarian form of government.
I wonder what happened around a year ago that prompted this creation. But let's dive into the Amazon Washington Post tweets, speeches that President Trump has given that prompted the op-ed you co-authored with Baron. Either of you wants to give me a little bit of a background?
Sure. So one of the things that we have worried about as an organization is the use of government power to crack down on perceived political enemies. That's something that you see in West Democratic and more autocratic governments overseas, and something that has largely been outside of normal policy bounds in the U.S. in recent administrations. And what we've seen recently from President Trump is some examples where he has strategized about or threatened to use the power of government to go after specific either people or companies, apparently because of their dissent or their speech. And Amazon and Trump's recent tweets and some of the reporting in Axios and elsewhere about Trump strategizing about Amazon are a classic example of this type of move.
Yeah, but at least he admits it. It's not like he's hiding anything.
Transparency, the main quality of this administration. Baron, so what exactly is Trump dissatisfied with Amazon with? Like, what is his problem with Jeff Bezos?
Well, one can only speculate. Some people think that it's a jealousy of a truly successful businessman who's built a real company that isn't based on real estate manipulation or politics. One might think that it's just about the Washington Post, which has been very critical of the Trump administration, which is owned by Jeff Bezos. And of course, the president has repeatedly made that connection. Or one might think that it's about Amazon and Trump's nostalgia for the 1950s America that he grew up in, where, you know, gosh darn it, people went to stores and overpaid for things because there was a complicated delivery system to get it to them. You know, who knows? But he said things about that suggest all of those factors. And I think in some ways he is the angry old man about shaking his fist at those kids and telling them to get off his lawn. And that's as true about the internet as about anything else. He clearly is uncomfortable, as many Americans are, with the way that the internet has revolutionized America, and looks at Amazon as just a poster boy for that change.
So Trump has repeatedly threatened to use antitrust law to change postal service rates and cancel defense contracts to harm the two Jeff Bezos-owned companies. What are the legal concerns that you guys raised in your op-ed? Do you mind going for them? So
I think that's great to get into, but I want to pause on what Baron mentioned, because I think from my perspective, it is great in our country and critical to be able to have a good, robust public debate about all of these types of economic policy questions of what role should internet retailers play and how consolidated should our economy be. That's something that we should encourage and embrace in a democracy. And to the extent that the president is trying trying to engage in or provoke that type of policy debate, wonderful, and he should be, you know, celebrated for it. What's concerning from, I think, both a policy and democracy perspective, but also a legal perspective, is either strategizing or threatening to use specific tools of government to punish or retaliate against a particular company because of their views, because they're competitors of the president's or other government officials' own business interests, because they may have ticked off a friend or things like that. And that's what starts to raise a lot of the constitutional issues that we'll talk through.
Or indeed, because Amazon directly competes with Trump's own properties, which are retail properties. So the fact that there may be a personal interest here, I think, is also important for understanding what is going on here and what sort of legal scrutiny we might want to apply.
So what legal concerns does this raise?
Well, first, there's Article 12 of the Constitution, as you know. No, but seriously, I mean, look, let's start with the First Amendment. We always start with the First Amendment. It's a lot of what we talk about on this show. And the fact is that the president is threatening to use government against one of the country's major newspapers for criticizing him. It is difficult to imagine a clearer First Amendment violation than that. The only thing that is perhaps unresolved here is the attack in some ways hasn't yet been completed. So you think about it in two ways, right? There's the use itself of government against your rivals, right? That is a clear First Amendment problem. And he's talking about what to do. It's not clear yet that he's actually done anything because he likes to talk. But the First Amendment case law recognizes that the threat itself is a serious problem. The government can't be allowed to threaten to use its own powers against critical speakers, because that effectively deters speech. It's what we call chilling effects. It's well supported in the case law. That itself is a problem, even if the president never actually does anything more.
And I think we've seen some of the examples of that, where you see commentators and journalists saying, I look at what's happening to CNN or what's happening to the Washington Post, and the clear lesson I draw from that is that the president is strategizing about how to use the tools of government to punish speech he doesn't like. And that has a very strong chilling effect, to use the legal term, on how people think about what they can write, what their companies will publish, what might get them in trouble.
So, Baron, you've mentioned that Trump has retail properties, and even though he stepped away from his business, one might assume, after he's done with his presidency, no matter how long it is, he would go back to running that business. Is there any legal...
Well, I'm not sure he's actually stepped away from running that business, but let's just, and he still owns the entire business, so I don't really accept the premise of the question, but I understand where you're going with that. Look, I mean, that's a much bigger topic here. It's not one that we've covered. I don't really have anything in particular to add on that. But I think, so we're talking first about actual legal problems. There's another problem, or another layer of this problem, which is the norms of behavior that govern government in general, and especially the president and other leading elected officials. And when you add that layer of personal self-interest, it if anything, would make a normal president even less inclined to go on the attack in a public way. And of course, that doesn't apply to this president, because he doesn't care about any of those norms. So I just add that as a layer throughout all of our discussion.
So I think there is a legal and, in fact, a constitutional dimension to this, which is that Article 2, not Article 12, imposes some requirements on how the president is supposed to go about his job of taking care that the law is faithfully executed. And that notion from the Take Care Clause of Article 2 of faithful execution includes, and the founders contemplated this in their remarks at the time, that the president has a sort of fiduciary duty to the public trust, and the president has to act in the public interest and not in a self-interest or a private interest. And so when you've got these very obvious questions about, is the president just doing this because it would benefit his own business interests during or post office, or because his supporters have real estate interests that are adverse to Amazon, that's when it's unclear whether the president is upholding his Article 2 responsibility from both the Take Care Clause and the Oath of Office to act in the public trust or not.
And I just want to point out that it's a great point that Justin makes, but that particular clause, of course, was something that Republicans constantly threw in the face of President Obama, alleging that he was not faithfully executing, enforcing, or overseeing the enforcement of the immigration laws. Right. So this is not a clause that Republicans in Congress are unfamiliar with. They just don't seem to think that it applies to this president.
So how does this fit in the historical context? So you mentioned the founding fathers. If we go down the line, President Nixon comes to mind. Can you draw parallels with it?
I think you can. And I don't want to paint an overly rosy picture of how these norms have played out in U.S. history, because there were periods of time when we had a much smaller government, where presidents were much more hands-on in their involvement in legal issues. But the modern norm post-Nixon has been that the White House and the president stay out of specific party enforcement matters. And that is reflected in a series of policies that every White House since Nixon has adopted that place limits on who from the White House can talk to who in the Justice Department, in what situations, with what safeguards. And they reach to things like who can be involved in decisions about grant making or contracting or rate setting or regulatory waivers. And the idea behind all of that is that agencies have very good systems in place to address those issues in a kind of equal and fair and consistent way. And when you have White House meddling, it brings in concerns about political interference and unequal treatment. And those all grew out of challenges in the Nixon era that have some eerie parallels to what we're seeing now.
So the real concern is precisely that we don't know what's happening behind the president's tweets. So some of his defenders might say, oh, it's just talk. He's just a New Yorker. You know, he's a funny guy. Well, when you have a president who actively talks about screwing Amazon and the Washington Post, you have to wonder what else is going on in the administration. And because this administration is so untransparent and will claim executive privilege about what happens inside the administration, we're not going to know. So it's really important. These norms that other White Houses have respected, it starts with issuing a policy on interference with a particular investigation, a particular enforcement matter, which this administration has not done. And then taking care never to seem like you're violating that policy. And yes. And that's just gone right out the door here. It's like, you know, the whole concern about campaign finance is not just corruption itself. It's even the appearance of corruption. And here we have the appearance of influence. And that's enough to be a problem. Whether or not we know, however long it might take for us to know exactly what the scope of interference truly was.
And he's a president. Even if he's not actively doing anything, the fact that he says, let's go after Amazon, might trigger people in government to go after Amazon.
Or someone with a gun.
Which, I mean, there's so many different shootings happening on campuses of different companies. Is unfortunately a very sad reality that we live in. So Justin and Barron, you guys mentioned what can be done about this in the executive branch, like the way executive branch can kind of come to a level of ethics. What about Congress and the judicial branch?
I think absolutely. And all three branches need to take this seriously. When we talk about the Constitution, people often immediately go to the courts and think, oh, that's the province of the courts. But in our system, everybody who serves in the executive branch takes an oath to uphold the Constitution. Members of Congress do. And both the executive branch and Congress are key institutions to give life to and enforce our key constitutional principles. So the executive branch, Barron, talked about how it's important to have policies in place that prevent White House interference. Folks in the White House need to be better about observing them. And people at the agencies can do that as well. And so if somebody at DOJ gets a call from the president, they can sort of say, hey, we're not taking this call. We're going to report this to the inspector general because it violates our policy. And we're going to make sure that the team that's working on this particular investigation is insulated. On the Congress side, there are a lot of tools that Congress has. It's got strong oversight powers if it wants to use them
has the power
to investigate these issues, to call administration witnesses in for hearings and try and get answers, to enforce that investigative request with subpoena threats. it can also legislate in this area. There have been bills introduced in the past that would codify some of these policies that limit contacts between the White House and DOJ. And in fact, there's a law on the books that limits people in the White House from reaching out to the IRS and asking the IRS to either audit or call off an audit on a specific taxpayer.
Which, remember, Republicans lost their minds about when it was Lois Lerner doing this to conservatives. But now that it's the president, a so-called Republican, threatening to do this to his critics, Congress seems to be pretty cool with that.
Is Barron alleging that DC is partisan? I'm just lost for words. And also relevant cases when they come up in courts, the judicial system should uphold constitutional rights of anyone who's unfairly targeted,
yeah, this, I would assume. This is tough. I don't expect either Congress or the courts to really fix this problem. One, because Congress is spineless and dysfunctional. And even when Democrats take over, of course, they'll seize on these topics for pure political advantage. Not that they would use these principles against one of their own, a president of their own party. But to get legislation passed, they'd have to get the president to sign it. That's not going to happen. So oversight could be very effective. Getting individual employees of the government to refuse to carry out orders that are unconstitutional could really make a difference. And of course, so could leaks. It's really important that that government employees blow the whistle when appropriate. Let's remember that the last administration, the Obama administration, brought more prosecutions against whistleblowers than any administration in American history. So we've already started to close the door on that even before we got to the Trump administration. And then the courts, you know, it's going to be hard to get these cases to the point where the courts are actually willing to seize on these issues. In other words, we may be perfectly right that these are constitutional problems. That doesn't mean that the courts are necessarily likely to act on them. Now, it doesn't stop us from raising them. Justin wrote a great brief, an amicus brief in the the Time Warner AT&T case that I'm sure he'll tell you about. It's important to raise those concerns every opportunity we have, but we shouldn't kid ourselves about how likely the courts are to actually focus on them. And it's worth noting that in that particular case, remember that AT&T had initially, in its initial legal comments, had initially raised this concern about interference. And they had demanded to have the Assistant Attorney General for Antitrust come and testify and talk about the White House intervention. And then they dropped that part of their argument.
So President Trump has heavily criticized CNN coverage of him. In some view, his efforts to block the AT&T and Time Warner merger is also a form of retaliation. As Barron mentioned, you guys filed a great brief in that case. Justin, do you mind talking a little bit about it?
Sure. So we filed a brief on behalf of about a dozen former Justice Department officials, people from both parties who had worked in the Bush administration, worked for President Obama. John Dean, President Nixon's White House counsel and DOJ official, was one of the signatories. And the argument that we made was that these are people who had worked in the Justice Department, who knew how it worked, who had great love and respect for the institution, but who feared that the president's public comments and the circumstances of DOJ's enforcement action in that merger, at a minimum, gave the appearance that there had been political interference, and laid out for the court why that type of political interference, if true, would implicate some of the constitutional provisions that we've talked about so far, the First Amendment, Article 2. Also, one thing we haven't really talked about is the Fifth Amendment, which includes both the Due Process Clause and which incorporates the 14th Amendment's guarantee of equal protection under the laws. And the brief provided the court with a very tight doctrinal set of tools that are available to courts to identify whether there has been political interference and to address it if it finds that. Now, unfortunately, in that case, the court has not shown any interest in diving into that issue. It decided not to accept our brief and not to dig into these issues. And so, you know, this is clearly one situation where Barron's pessimism has played out, that the judiciary is resistant. But this is one judge, and I remain optimistic that this is exactly the type of thing that in our constitutional system courts are not just well situated to do, but are supposed to do. These are specific parties that have had their constitutional rights potentially infringed upon by government. And in that situation, when you're before a court, in our system, the court is supposed to give you an opportunity to find out what happened and to provide redress if you were wronged. And nothing about that is a sort of extension or unusual role for courts to play in our country.
But it's not that the courts are resistant. It's that you need plaintiffs who are willing to push these cases. And if even AT&T, which initially brought this case and raised this concern, decided to drop that part of the concern, I think that tells you a lot, which in particular is that regulated parties, I mean, no matter how much they may resent being attacked by the administration, they're going to have to be pushed pretty far to be willing to fight that case in court. And it is, let me just put it this way. You could see this pattern play out repeatedly in a grossly unconstitutional way over the next 3 to, God help us, 7 years, and yet never see one of these cases actually litigated. Now, that does not mean that these constitutional principles are not important and that we shouldn't talk about them. We should understand them. Law enforcement should understand them. Members of Congress should understand them. And in particular, government employees should understand them so that they can know when they're being asked to do something unconstitutional. This is not just about trying to get the courts to save us.
No, I agree that it is really hard for companies or other specific people to stand up in these situations. And I think while there are some antitrust issues to consider here, that companies would be wise to band together and think about, you know, non-aggression pact type ideas, that if you go after one, you've gone after all, that will back each other up in amicus briefs and the like. Because I do think it's important to maintain the rule of law, to maintain a society where people are free to criticize government and to take business actions and interests opposed to those in power, that people are willing to do that and not feel like the government will punish them for it.
So protect the democracy.
Protect our democracy, protect our rule
good,
of law.
Good luck with that.
I wouldn't want to let you go without asking about the special investigation, the special counsel investigation into the election meddling. Do you guys do any work on this? As far as I understand, what are your ideas?
We do some work on it, and there's a clear link between the work that we're doing on these attacks by the president against businesses and on the president's meddling with the Russia investigation, because the clear principle that comes from the Constitution is that the president is supposed to let law enforcement do its job in an independent way and is not supposed to step in corrupt or self-interested ways and interfere with specific law enforcement investigations. And just as he appears to be doing that, or maybe doing that with asking for antitrust investigations of different companies, he's doing the same thing when he interferes in the Mueller investigation, whether by firing investigators or trying to dangle pardons in front of witnesses so they won't cooperate. And so this core principle that the president is supposed to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, but is not supposed to go intervening and putting his thumb down or lifting it up in specific law enforcement matters, comes out quite strongly in the Mueller investigation.
No, it is some reason for optimism that actually, you know, law is made by testing principles, and these principles are being tested in that context. And this may come to a head. I mean, that actually may be litigated. So as much as I'm pessimistic that we're going to see individual companies who are willing to stand up for themselves against regulators that they have to deal with all the time or the antitrust division, I do actually think that it's in this area of the Mueller investigation that you could see some very helpful law developed that would actually perhaps make companies more willing to step up for themselves when the president is interfering in an enforcement matter that affects them directly.
And I was just going to say that I think Congress has an absolutely critical role here, and I have a slightly rosier view of what Congress could do on this set of issues than Barron does. I agree the current Congress, the current president, we're not going to see a strong legislative change. That's just not going to happen. But I think there is going to be a day after Trump, and there's going to be an opportunity for Congress to close some of the loopholes that Trump has exploited and to codify some of the norms that he's violated. And we saw that after Nixon and Watergate with the Church Commission and Ethics in Government Act. And I think we'll see the same appetite and opportunity here. And this this is a clear place where Congress can step in and put some limits on to prevent this type of presidential attacks on specific people or interference in specific investigations.
And the simple way to put that is, I think it has become abundantly clear that Congress cannot expect the White House, in any individual White House, to enact or abide by policies that will restrain the president. Right? That had worked since Nixon. That's why Congress didn't need to legislate in this area. It clearly doesn't work now. And I agree that hopefully there will be a moment of sanity when Democrats and Republicans who have a moment of buyer's remorse on that terrible Monday morning hangover realize that they have to do something about this.
So what would be your final thoughts for our listeners to take away?
My final thought is, this is not a partisan issue. It's not about Obama. It's not even just about Trump. It's about what's the type of country we want to live in and what type of role do we want government to play in how it enforces the law. And I think Barron and I probably have pretty different ideas on sort of what type of regulatory policy our country should have, how aggressive our enforcement should be in different areas. But I think we should all agree that our laws should be enforced in neutral and fair ways that treat like cases like, and that don't go after people because of their opinions or their political participation, or let them off the hook because they're friends of those in power. And what we're seeing now is a clear violation of those basic rule of law American principles.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I generally favor law enforcement approaches to regulatory ones. And if anything, that means it's all the more important that the integrity and independence of law enforcement agencies be maintained, right? I think antitrust is, as a general matter, is the baseline for how we deal with economic concerns, is generally superior to regulation. And no one incident has done more to undermine the integrity, the independence, the expertise, the respect the Department of Justice commands in bringing enforcement actions than this one. And it may take a long time to recover from that damage. But at the end of the day, it comes down to when you're at trial and you've got an expert witness making a case, the fact is that the courts have granted some degree of informal deference to the agency because it's been perceived as, for decades, being a straight shooter. And I don't believe that anymore. I mean, they might be right. They might not be. When I look at the particular facts of their case against the AT&T Time Warner merger, it seems absurd to me. Even under their model, they predict that the increase in prices under their most conservative assumption would be a matter of pennies to consumers, right? In other words, even they don't think that there's actually a lot of harm here. And in fact, there might be no harm at all. And one has to wonder why they're really pursuing this case.
Well, we'll have to have Justin back to talk more about antitrust and see you two disagree more. But for now, thank you, gentlemen, for joining. We're going to link to your op-ed and to Protect Democracy's brief in our show notes. And we're looking forward to having you back and maybe seeing this case go to a more optimistic end. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks much for having me on. I enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks.
You can follow Tech Freedom on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Please leave us a review so others can find the show.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.